We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the Youth League football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
On the Wolfpack Sports Network from Learfield IMG College.
Play ball!
Welcome to the Nevada Wolfpack Baseball Podcast. Here's your host, Josh Sushon.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Howling with the Pack. This is a podcast about the Nevada Wolfpack baseball team. I'm your host, Josh Sushon. We're now up to episode 3. A little bit later in episode 3, head coach TJ Bruce will join us, but this week our special guest, just like last week, is a former member of the Pack who is now playing professional baseball. He played for Nevada in 2016. He was drafted by the Tampa Bay Rays that year in the 14th round. He has steadily progressed through the Rays organization, which, by the way, in 2019 was named the Farm System of the Year. In 2019, he spent most of the year at AA, got a brief cameo at AAA. Did not get a chance to play last year because of the pandemic, but he just got finished with his second year at big league spring training. And it seemed like every time that I'm on Twitter, I see that he's making a diving catch or he's throwing somebody out or he's hitting a home run or another home run or a third home run and really opening up eyes. His name is Miles Mastroboni. Miles, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, what's going on? Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So let's start right with spring training again. I think you had a fantastic camp and really opened up a lot of eyes. You're going to be at the alternate camp when Major League Baseball starts. What were some of just your biggest takeaways about what you were able to do on the month of March with the Rays?
Yeah, I mean, it was a long year back in 2020, and kind of leading into this year, it was just a lot of question marks, you know, just not. It was the first time I haven't played baseball competitively in a game for a whole year. And, you know, you're going back to summer ball. It's like you got a 2-week break, then you're hopping right back into school. Then right when school gets done, you're hopping right back into summer ball. So it was just there was a lot of question marks. There's a lot of, dang, we got to get this thing going. You know, you don't really have kind of a something to look back on and be like, well, I did this last year. Now let's try and do this. It's kind of like, well, I did this back in 19. Let's see what we can do now here in 2021. So it just felt good to get back out there with all the guys and see everybody again, kind of get the juices flowing, get back to that competitive nature. And it was, I think just that part of it, you know, was definitely a good feeling to have again. So
Yeah. So this past weekend, TJ and I were talking about how no matter what the sport is or what the level is, there's a time when you say, okay, I think I can play at this level. And then there's, I know that I can play at this level, whether you're going from high school to college or college to pro ball or minor league ball to to the major league. So where are you in that progression? And what did this March do for you in terms of, I think I can play in the major leagues too, I know I can play in the major leagues?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it goes into preparation. You know, when everything kind of opened back up, I was spending a lot of time with my parents in Jersey. So when things opened back up beginning of September, gym wise, I mean, I just got right back into there. I was kind of just grinding and doing everything I can to get ready for 2021, just to make sure that I'm ready for that time. And it's been kind of crazy in a sense of that, but just doing that, knowing that the preparation is going to kind of take its course. Once things got kind of running, things just kind of took off to kind of where they were, you know, back in 2019. I'm kind of happy that it went like that. Cause in the back of your mind, you know, you're thinking, can I still do this? Like, I haven't seen myself in a year. So just getting that confidence instilled back in you, deep down inside, you always believe in yourself and you always try and say, I can do this, right? You know, going out there and proving it might be a different story, but just getting able to get off to a good foot, you know, get a good start, I mean, and get that kind of confidence instilled. I think that was a huge thing for me getting back into spring and everything like that. So once I was able to do that, kind of get my feet wet, you know, get around all the guys again and kind of just start chopping it up with them, you know, see how they're doing, things like that. I think that kind of helps with everything. So it was good for sure.
So Miles, you've spent your entire life playing baseball, going back to little league, high school, junior college, Nevada, minor league ball. When it gets taken away from you, when you're not able to play for an entire season, what does that remind you about the sport that you've played your whole life?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely something that it's one of those things where when it gets taken away from you, you know, you really realize what you really had, you know. It's, I mean, for me, waking up every day playing baseball, like, that's, I mean, that's a dream come true, right? This is something that I've dreamed about with my dad, like, ever since I was growing up, you know, watching big league games and, you know, seeing how they go about their business and stuff like that. And it's like, now all of a sudden, in the snap of fingers, it was just gone like that. No warning, no nothing. So, you know, it gets tough. But, you know, my parents were great with it. A lot of talks at the dinner table, what's going to go on, how I'm feeling, this or that. But I mean, my parents were great. My agent was great. And, you know, just to bounce ideas off of and trying to keep me on a level head, because it got tough. You know, you just want to go out there and prove what you got, but you know, you also got to be patient at the same time. And patience is not what Italians have, you know, so. but it was definitely humbling. You know, it made me work harder, I think. And like I said, it's just been good that, you know, we're able to get back out here again and do what we love to do for a living. So.
So you mentioned growing up, and you grew up in Livermore, which has a big youth baseball scene. Just how early did you start playing baseball? Like, when did you first, do you remember like the first time that you got a glove or that you played catch with your dad or that you got involved in like youth baseball?
I mean, as little as I can remember, I'm an October birthday, so I started early. I started T-ball when I was four. And I mean, it kind of just, my parents told me I was the kid that was just running around everywhere, couldn't stay in one position, sliding all over the field, that kind of thing. So it just started from, you know, from a young age, and just played it kind of ever since, just growing up, loved it. You know, I've been able to play on some really good teams in the Bay Area and stuff like that. And you know, it was great.
Yeah. And you got an older brother, Marcus, who played professional baseball as well. He was a catcher. How much did you just tag along with your older brother everywhere he went, or how much did you guys get to play alongside one another?
We didn't get to really play too much together, because like growing up, the travel ball scene, it's pretty competitive. And he would play 2 years older than me, I want to say. Because he was a year and 11 months older than me. So I think he played 2 years above me. So it's kind of a big jump, you know, going from like if 12 or from 10 to 12U or, you know, vice versa or whatever the case may be. So, but what we did get is my sophomore year, we got to play. I got brought up on varsity and we were able to play that year. And that year was pretty special. It's something that I hold on to. I'm going to hold on to for the rest of my life for sure. Just because it's rare to get to play with a brother and stuff like that. And, you know, we've grown a very good relationship and he's helped me to get, he's a huge reason why I'm still doing what I'm doing today. So it was a very memorable year for sure for me. And I mean, even probably even more for my parents, which was good.
I read that, and I don't know what year it was for you in high school, but you know, you go to Granada High School in Livermore, unless you're from the Bay Area, you probably don't know where that is, but that's, yeah. You guys were ranked top 25 in the nation. So for little Granada High, like what was that like for you and your teammates to kind of bring that kind of exposure to your high school?
Yeah, it was kind of, I mean, it was crazy. Like I would say for my sophomore year, like the year my brother was a senior, they had a pretty good team. They made it to the NCS for the first time in a while. And then the next 2 years, we just had a group of guys that grew up playing together. All of them played Little League. I grew up on the other side of town, so I didn't really get to play with these guys, but all of them played Granada Little League. All of them played either on the same team travel ball at some point or were playing against each other in travel ball. So it was just like one of those things where like everybody knew who they were. We had a close group of guys. Everybody got along with everybody. The juniors meshed well with the seniors. And it was a one in a lifetime team. I mean, it was a crazy talented team. Guys that went on and played pro ball, guys that went on and played college, a good amount of them. So it was just one of those kind of freak teams, but one of the best teams that I've definitely been a part of and the most fun that I've had being on the baseball field.
These days you play all over the field, but in high school and college, when you're at Nevada, you played shortstop. Who were the shortstops that you watched closest and said like, I want to be like that guy. Or I just need to watch him closely to see how he goes about his business.
Derek Jeter was a big one. I mean, I feel like my generation, maybe a little bit older, I would say I'm probably right at the bottom since he made his debut when the year I was born. So growing up and watching him was incredible. You know, just the way he went about his business on and off the field, how he handled New York media and how insane the media is when you get into a big spot like New York and how he just handled it. And he shows you how it is to be a true winner and everything like that. And just, I remember I wanted to throw like him. My dad got me his glove when I was younger and like the model that you get at Big Five and stuff like that. So, I mean, he was a good guy to really look up to. I mean, definitely one of the best in the game, I think. And definitely someone, even though I'm a lefty, I tried to still mimic, you know, his actions and the way he went about his business on the field. So
when it comes to coming to games in the Bay Area, did you go to more A's games, more Giants games? I'm trying to think who the shortstops would have been. Probably Brandon Crawford still, maybe Bobby Crosby. I guess Marcus Semien was, you were already out of high school by the time that Semien was there. There's been some good shortstops in the Bay, maybe the tail end of Tejada. Who are some of the Bay Area shortstops?
Vizquel was there, right?
That's right. Yeah. Omar Vizquel at the tail end of his career.
I played. So he was the manager of AA when I was in 19. So I got to see Omar and everything and watch him do his hand tricks and stuff like that. So that was pretty cool. But to be honest, so my parents, they grew up East Coast. So my dad grew up Rutherford, Hoboken right there, right across from Manhattan. And my mom grew up in the Bronx and everything like that. My dad was a big baseball guy and it was Yankees all the way. So I didn't really watch too much of like the Bay Area teams just because like my dad had the New York channel when we were out in California and it was always just Yankee games. And they were always on early because back the time difference and everything like that. But we would always go out and when the Yankees came into town, we'd usually go watch a game. We spent most of our time probably at the Coliseum. Just because it was a little tougher to get into the city and stuff like that. But, yeah, there were some good guys on that. When you had Frank Thomas there, that was pretty fun to watch. Yeah, I mean, so it was good.
When you left high school, you ended up going to the College of San Mateo for 2 years. Give us kind of like the view of like where you were as a player and what you were looking for, what opportunities you had, which ultimately led you to Nevada for your junior year.
San Mateo is a huge part of why I made it to like kind of where I'm at now and continue. I've taken so much stuff that I've learned there and stuff that I've just had to like learn on my own with growing up at San Mateo that has gotten me to this point and is what helped me succeed when I got to Nevada. Out of high school, every kid's dream is to go D1 if they're not drafted. So I really wanted to do that. I was talking to a lot of coaches and, you know, things just kind of fell through. And I had a kind of a down senior year too, which didn't help. But San Mateo, they came in and they came in hot. And I just loved their coach. I loved the way that their coaching staff, when I went out and talked to them and everything, it felt like the coaching staff that would fit me. And it couldn't have been a better choice to go to San Mateo. And the stuff that I learned from Coach Williams and Brett Thomas, Coach Weeks, Folds, who was the pitching coach. And then we called him 5-0. He would stop in. And we had Nochi, who was he's a pretty well-known guy from out there in San Mateo when he coached the Bulldogs back there in the late 1980s, 90s, early 2000s, maybe, I want to say. So he, you know, learning stuff from him, and it was kind of crazy just the amount of information that I was able to soak in within those 2 years before I left and, you know, and then was able to get the opportunity to go to Nevada, which was a very fun time too, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah. So you were part of TJ Bruce's first team, 2016, team finished 37-24, third place in the Mountain West. You finished the year winning 20 of the last 24 games. You guys really got hot. You got to the championship game of the Mountain West Conference tourney, but then you lost there, which would have taken you to the NCAAs. What are some of your just biggest memories that you recall best from that season with the Wolfpack?
That year, we went through a lot. We went through with the coaching change. I committed with Johnson and Lon and Curtanian and all those guys that were there. And I got to summer ball, and one of my buddies, Cole Krasmarzik, he's like, "Hey, did you hear Johnson just left?" And I was like, "Oh my gosh, here we go." I'm like, "Gosh, dang it." And so then I started to hear who were the coaches that were in the running for it. And then once I heard that Coach Bruce got it, all I heard was he was this infield guru, right? So I was sitting there and I had like a few days to kind of like think about it and like what I really wanted to do. And, you know, I kind of made up my mind and I was like, well, if this guy's come from UCLA, he's won a national championship recently, you know, within the last 3 years. And I was like, this guy could probably do huge things for my career and put me in the spot that I want to be in. Right. And so he ended up calling me and I was like, "Hey, I hear you're this infield guy." So I'm an infield guy too. And I think this could be a really good fit. You know, I think you're going to help me huge defensively. And it ended up being a good choice to stick there. I mean, he did crazy things for me and got my defense in a spot that I never thought I'd ever get to. So to have that, the group of guys were by far the best memory from that. I mean, I was in the shower before I got on the Zoom call and I'm like, I still talk to about 15 to 20 guys that were still on that team, you know, some guys constantly on a weekly basis. And the memories that we made with that team, I mean, we started out at one point, I want to say we were like 5-12, and just the determination that all the guys had to get our season back on track, to not be selfish, to want to do it for everybody else on the team, and to go on that last run that we had to end the season. I mean, that was, I think we won like 13 straight, and then we went into New Mexico, played a tough ass game. Lost, I want to say 5-4, like 4-3, or I can't remember. I know it was a really close game and snapped our streak. And then we went right into the Mountain West tournament and killed it. I mean, it was just everything a part of that season was memorable. I mean, I got so many pictures with guys and stuff that I still look back on and stuff like that. And, you know, it was definitely a memorable one for sure.
When you mentioned the infield guru, that is TJ Bruce, I love watching him at practice, working with the infielders and some of the different drills that he'll do with them. Is there, you know, we can kind of nerd out on some shortstop stuff here in terms of like a drill that you did, or whether it's footwork or whether it's like throwing from different arm angles where that just really helped elevate your game defensively?
Yeah. So when I got there, Bruce can even probably attest for himself, my feet were really bad. And every day he would just let me know, move your feet, move your feet. And I didn't really understand what that really meant. And he took ground balls with me. And I got like that. I'm a big visual learner. So like, I like to see somebody do it. And when he did that and I finally grasped what he was trying to say, that's when my infield went through the roof, I thought personally. And I thought the way that he told me how to move my feet, and it's not necessarily meaning you need to go forward all the time. You can move back, you know, side to side, this or that. That really helped big time. And we did a lot of barehanded drills, rolling balls, just catching barehand, stuff like that, working backhand, forehand, everything. And that I thought is what really, cause then when you throw the glove on, you're like, damn, I got this huge thing now on my hand. And now all of a sudden, you know, you're like, everything's working into that pocket now, you know what I'm saying? And just being able, you really got to concentrate when you don't have a glove on. So when you throw the glove on and you really look the ball in and stuff like that, now everything kind of just comes easily. And that really helped with my defense big time.
I love hearing draft day stories. They never get old to me. Whether it's someone from the 80s who gets a telegram, you know, a week later, or whether it's someone from this era who's just watching on a laptop. What was draft day like for you in 2016?
Crazy. As of right now, I would say probably the best day of my life so far, just because, I mean, it's a dream kind of to hear your name called. So it was it was kind of crazy leading up to it. I had a really bad fall once I got to Nevada, and going into the season, I didn't really hear anything. So I was planned on going into the season. I'm like, hey, I'll be here for another year. Let's do this thing. You know, let's get off to a good foot, get a good start. And let's kind of get my name kind of out there. You know, all of a sudden I just kind of started off hot, kind of just crazy, didn't think I had it kind of in me kind of thing. And I just tried to run with it. And next thing you know, like, I get a text from Coach Bruce during the year. This is before draft. And he's like, I want you to come in and see me. And he sat me down and he pretty much told me like, yo, this is like a thing for you now. Like, you are doing really well. And there's your name's floating around a lot between scouts, between cross checkers, this and that, agents. And I'm like, I'm kind of sitting there like, oh my God, you know, I'm like, are you serious? And you know, Coach Bruce, he's not a guy to really hype someone up unless it's really there. So I'm like, oh yeah, maybe this is something. So we were talking a lot leading up to the draft and stuff like that, what I wanted to do and everything. And it led to the day, and I was hoping to sneak in possibly to the second day, late second day. Didn't happen. Got a few calls after the third day or after the second day. You still want to get drafted? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So I wake up, my mom wakes me up that next morning. Cause I was kind of like, you know, you're kind of mad cause you obviously want to go and you know, it doesn't happen. She's like, it's about to start, this or that. And I'm like, all right, whatever. I'm just watching a movie on the TV and my dad's got the laptop up and he's sitting at the kitchen table, like literally staring at the screen. And I'm just like watching a movie. And all of a sudden I hear Tampa Bay select. I'm just hearing the position. And if the position rings a bell, I'm like, oh, you know, and I hear second baseman and I'm like, it catches my attention. And I hear my name. And I was like, I looked like dead over at my dad. My dad looks at me and he's like, are you kidding me? He's like, the Rays? And at this point, like, I haven't even gotten a phone call yet or anything. Like, I hear sometimes like teams usually call, hey, you know, we're looking at taking you here for this amount of money, this or that. The Rays ended up just taking me. And, you know, it was kind of, man, it's history ever since. So it was a great day. to just kind of feel all the love and support and the text messages kind of flown in, you know. I mean, without all the people supporting you and everything, and it's a huge help. So to get all those kind of things, very appreciative and thankful. So
what do you remember about the first time you walked into a professional clubhouse? You were with Hudson Valley, if I recall, New York Penn League, short season ball, and just what it meant to walk through a clubhouse as a professional baseball player.
Scary. Very scary. Honestly, I remember sitting on the plane ride on the way over there and just being so antsy and nervous. And the one thing that kind of settled me down a little bit was when I was leaving and my parents were like, this is everything you've ever worked for. You know, you've put in the work to get you to this point, and now just let everything kind of just run its course, let everything take over. And then when you get into the off season, then you know what you need to work on, and we'll work some more and stuff like that. And the thing that was great was everybody kind of in the baseball world, everybody's a good guy. There's just very good individuals around the world of baseball. And that makes it a lot, you know, makes it so much easier to go in and, you know, a guy goes up, hey man, I'm so-and-so, good to meet you, like, glad to have you, this or that. And, you know, it makes a huge difference, and a comfortability factor is a huge part in sports and being able to get comfortable and kind of get, you know, and get going and stuff like that. So once I was able to do that and kind of take that kind of deep breath and, all right, you know, you can do this. You know, it gets a little bit easier, but then, you know, you got to make sure that you stay on your work and really get after it.
Yeah, because the Rays, I mean, it's remarkable what Tampa Bay does to just continue to just churn out players. But then also the competition on the field, but then competition amongst your teammates. I mean, the farm system's loaded, like, year loaded. After year. So, like, what can you tell us about what it's like being with an organization that may not have the biggest major league budget, but just knows how to produce players?
Kind of a fun part about it, too, is just going out every day and watching some of these guys just – play the sport. I mean, you're watching guys hit the ball to the moon, and you're seeing, you know, you got Wander Franco in there, short, smooth, you know, you got Taylor Walls, you got all these guys that can pick it. The thing that's great about it is, like, you sit down and you talk with these guys. Hey, what are you feeling when you're doing this or that? It's a lot of bouncing ideas off of each other. What works for them? And then you kind of say, well, this is what I've been feeling. And he'd be like, hey, I got something for you. And you're like, damn, bro, that actually really, that makes total sense. Right. And just seeing that, watching them go about their business, you know, you pick and choose, like, oh, you're doing that. That's what kind of gets you ready. And you pick and choose. You're like, oh, I think that could work for me. Something like that. Or, you know, when you're in the cage, you're chatting over swing thoughts, approaches at the plate, things like that. I mean, you know, that's when it gets kind of fun, you know, to hear kind of what works for certain people, what doesn't work, why they do certain things, why they don't do certain things. I think that's a huge thing. And, you know, when you're with an organization that's got just a load of guys that have talent, it makes you work hard. You know, you got guys that are coming right behind you that are talented, and it's one way or the other. You're either going up or you're going down. So there's no kind of, if you're hovering, you're really not, you know, you're not making a name for yourself. So you have that in the back of your mind always. And you're like, oh, well, I know I got somebody coming right behind me who's just as good as me, if not better. So I need to kind of get a little pep in my step. So it's kind of good for the, you know, to have competition. And when you have competition there, it makes you work hard, it gets you better, period. So I love that part of it, which is good.
One of my favorite things to do during batting practice is watch middle infielders just practice turning double plays, or they're just like throwing, you know, this angle, that angle, and where they're just like scooping with their glove and no hands. Is there a double play partner that you've been with in pro ball where you're just like, it was just so much fun to just kind of work on things with him?
Yeah. I mean, I played with Lucius Fox. He's now with the Royals. He was a big guy with the Giants. Got traded over in the Matt Moore deal, I want to say. I played with him 17, 18, and 19. So I was with him a lot. And so, I mean, comfortability-wise, I was most comfortable with him because we were always playing together. He was playing short, I was playing second. I remember my first year I spelled him a few days at short when he would have an off day or whenever he would DH or anything like that. He's doing his thing with the Royals now. I would say, I mean, Walls is in there. I've been able to play a good amount with Wander this spring. So me and him still got a little bit of, I wouldn't say like stuff to work on, but just knowing each other, I need to know him a little better, you know, vice versa. What balls he can get to, what balls he can't, you know, things like that. Just like the little things, but Walls is another big one. I don't know if I just said him. Played a bunch with him. So, I mean, those guys, yeah. I mean, you kind of – they're all the same in their sense, but they got their certain stuff that you know, oh, he does that, you know, this guy does this. Mm-hmm. So you kind of – you learn it, and once you learn it, it becomes really fun when you're up the middle with those guys.
And now you're playing all over the field. How many different gloves do you have for what different positions that you play? Like, do you need like a super small one at second versus like a little bit bigger at third versus much bigger in the outfield or what?
Yeah. So ideally I would probably carry a third base glove, a second and shortstop glove, and then an outfield glove. And then I played first for the first time in my whole career this spring training. So I'd probably hold off on that until I would start playing it a little bit more. I'll probably just use a buddies for right now. But right now I ended up going up just a quarter of a size in my infield glove to make it more all around the field where I can use it at third base as well as it's not too big at short and second as well. And then I got my outfield glove too. So there's times when I'm trying to break in a new glove, I'm carrying 3 in, 4 in to the park and stuff like that. So your hands are full. You usually got one on your head, you know, 2 or 3 in the hand. So it's all good though. It's fun because you're doing something different every day, right? You know, you're taking ground balls one day, then you're in the outfield the next. It's not super repetitive where you're taking ground balls every single day, and which is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. I kind of like the side of I get to go in the outfield one day, come back in the infield the next, you know, but you know, just kind of mix it around. I like that kind of versatileness that keeps me on my toes. So
You've steadily progressed through the Rays organization from short A to low A to high A to double A. You got a little cameo at triple A in 2019. Do you have a favorite ballpark or just a favorite memory of look, you know, your time in the minor leagues, whether it was a home park or a road park? I know 4th of July games are always super fun in the minor leagues because
those are really fun.
Yeah. Cause it's almost always a sellout. There's fireworks. But anything that stands out, you're like, man, this is so cool.
I'm going to go with 3 parks. In low A, I played in Fort Wayne, Indiana, which I want to say that's the nicest one. I didn't like hitting there because it was kind of big and I didn't really have too much power at the time. I think Dayton, Ohio, I think that's number one playing surface. They sell out every game, 6,000 fans at least every single game. Weekends, they get close to 10. Fort Wayne was the same way. And then I just played in a stadium back in 19 AA, Birmingham, Alabama. Their field was super nice. Playing surface was pristine. No bad hops on the infield. Nice park to hit in as well. And I hear – so when I went up to AAA, we were on the road. So I heard Durham is a spot and a half too. So, but, yeah, those 3 stick out right now. Yep.
I like asking this question and I make it a little bit more dramatic than it needs to be, but that's what makes it fun too, is that if time travel was possible, you know, and you could get in the DeLorean, you know, that Dr. Emmett Brown made, and you go back in time, mm-hmm. like Marty McFly, and you could run into yourself, what advice would you give to a younger Miles about what the future holds and what you need to do in order to be successful?
That's a really good question. I think there's a few parts to it that I would really like to tell myself if I could really travel to the future. I think the biggest one is never shy away from the competition side of things. I remember leaving high school, you know, you get to a junior college where you got a lot of guys that are there, and you know, you got 3-4 guys at each spot, and you're like, dang, you really I gotta beat out all these guys. You know, there's only 9 guys that are gonna play every day, and I gotta beat out, you know, 5-6 different guys and stuff like that. But that's when it really gets fun, right? You know, that's when you really find out who you are kind of deep down inside, what levels you're willing to go to get to where that you want to be, and, you know, take care of all your schoolwork, do all that kind of stuff. But when it comes baseball time, like, it's time to get after it. And once you step on the field, like, for those 3 hours, those 2.5 hours, it's go. And, you know, do everything game-like. That was a huge thing that Coach Bruce really taught me. Practice should be the hard part. When it comes to the game, you already did that in practice. You already know that you can do it. So when it comes game time, it should just come naturally. And when I took that really to heart, I was like, that's how it is. I used to get nervous when I was younger for games and stuff like that. Once I got to Bruce and he really instilled that in me, once it came game time, I mean, of course I still get nervous because, you know, if you don't get nervous, why still even play? But it's a good kind of nervous. It's not the nervous of like, am I prepared enough? No, you know, you're prepared. You're nervous just because this is just what you wanted to do your whole life. You want to do well, but deep down in your mind, you're like, I know I've done it in practice already. So this is exactly where you want to be. And I think that's what I would tell myself. When times, you know, when it seems like you really can't get out of that tunnel, where you want to get to that end goal, just keep pushing through it. Keep pushing through it. There's light at the end of that tunnel. And I know it might seem dark at times and you're like, you know, am I really going to get there? And the hard work that you put in, the constant getting in the cage, taking extra ground balls, doing all that kind of stuff, you'll get to that end goal. And, you know, like I said, at times, even I would say throughout my journey, even when I was in the minor leagues, when I got drafted, there's been numerous times where I'm like, can I really get to the big leagues? Can I really get to D1 from junior college? Can I really get drafted from Division I? And looking back on it, after those kind of things happen, I was like, I really worked for it. I put in everything that I needed to do. And at times, of course, you're going to think, yeah, I could probably put in some more. Just knowing that all the hard work that you put in, the countless time in the cage, on the field, it's going to pay off. And that's definitely what I would tell myself if I could go back in time.
Last question, and then we'll let you go. The people who are listening to this podcast are not going to be able to see it, but I can see that you're wearing a Nevada t-shirt right now.
Had to.
Yeah, and we're glad to see it. It was only 1 year, but in the grand scheme of your life, what did that 1 year in Reno, going to the University of Nevada, playing for the Wolfpack, what did that mean to your life?
I mean, that's 1 year of my life that I had probably one of the best times that I could like ever think of, school wise and baseball. Like I said, the group of guys that were there, I mean, another one of those teams that are super high on my list, the most fun, the most competitive. Those guys had some dogs on that team. You know, everybody that was on that team was talented for sure. Maybe not compared to your big SEC schools or your Power Five or whatever the case may be, but we could have, the heart that was on that team, we could have played with anybody. It was a beautiful campus. The community, they really back up that university, which was super fun to see, and see the support come out for games and stuff like that. Going into college, I remember my dad always told me, like, these are the best times of your life. And looking back on my time at San Mateo and looking back, especially on Nevada, I can look back and say those were some of the funnest times that I've had in my life. And, you know, like I said, a lot of it goes to the guys that were there that I was able to share them with, coaching staff, friends that I was able to meet. Nevada has definitely turned me into where I've gotten in my life baseball wise, but it's also helped me off the field as well. You know, just all the stuff that Coach Bruce, taught, you know, getting you ready for not just the baseball, but the real world as well, because, you know, not everybody, you know, is fortunate enough to go on and play baseball for a long time. And I'm super humble and fortunate that I'm able to keep doing this. And it's just been, it's been great to look back on those times and know that it was a huge stepping stone of to where I am now in my life. So it's definitely I'm very grateful for my time in Nevada.
All right, Miles.
I wish great. I was able to spend the full 3 years or maybe four. So
yeah, I'm sure a lot of Wolfpack fans are thinking the same thing. I wish we could have had him for at least three, if not four. Yeah. Great stuff. Awesome. Thanks for being so generous with your time and so candid with your memories and everything. This was awesome. Keep doing you and make us proud.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, Josh. I really appreciate it. It was fun.
Once again, that is Miles Mastroboni. We'll take a quick pause here on episode 3 of Howling with the Pack, and then we'll come back with head coach TJ Bruce, and we'll dive a little bit more into what makes him an infield guru. This is Howling with the Pack.
As powerful as the Lexus RX.
As many safety features as the RX.
With an interior just as refined as the RX.
If they're talking about you, you must be doing something right. Experience the Lexus RX, the leading luxury SUV of all time. See Dolan Lexus.
Based on manufacturer's published data, May 3rd, 2018.
Episode 3 of Howling with the Pack continues, and we now bring in the head coach for the Nevada Wolf Pack. He was just referred to as the infielder's guru multiple times by Miles Mastroboni. When you hear a former pupil, by the way, hello, TJ. When you hear a former player refer to you as the infielder's guru, what do you think?
We're just all here to try to help these kids. And the number one thing I do know, the number one thing about coaching, you can't do anything without good players. And just super fortunate to have been able to coach somebody like Miles with that athleticism, the arm strength, the baseball IQ, all the above. So Miles did all the work, and Miles. So I should be saying he's the infield guru, and I'll just stand back and watch.
Well, it might take a long time to list all of the infielders that TJ has helped, tutored over his career as an assistant, as a head coach. So we're going to mostly focus on those who have made it to the major leagues. When he was at Long Beach State, Matt Duffy, Danny Espinoza, Evan Longoria, Troy Tulowitzki. When he was at UCLA, Pat Valleca, Kevin Kramer. Hopefully Miles joins that major league list sometime this season. So let's start with this, TJ. First of all, did I forget anyone who's in the major leagues who you've worked with?
I don't think so. You mentioned Kramer and Valleca, right?
Yeah.
So I don't think so. I think we got some guys on the brink. You know, I think Miles will probably be the next one, it looks like, God willing. And, you know, he stays healthy and all that stuff. So, but no, I think you nailed most of them.
Okay. So let's start with this. When you're looking at an infielder, in particular, a shortstop, there's a lot of different things that make up an infielder, but what do you look for first? Are you looking at the way they move their feet? Are you looking at their arm strength? Are you looking at different arm angles? Are you looking at reaction, command? Like, what do you look for first when you see a shortstop?
The first thing for me is, you know, do they catch the ball? I think that's number one. And I know that sounds a little off. Like, yeah, they're supposed to catch the ball. Yeah, but there's something that goes into really catching the ball. And I know you can, you know, just basically where the ball is in the glove. I think that's a huge, huge deal. And that's, you know, either you can help somebody in some way, or you just know right off the bat, hey, I can't help this guy do what he needs to do to be successful. So that's number one. And that's always pretty obvious, even in the playing catch portion of it. You know, watch guys play catch. Like with our guys here, always watch how our guy, I'm always on our guys about how they carry their glove. You know, I think there's a certain stiffness or looseness to the wrist that helps you. And it's hard. It's like, I always think it's like an arm bar in hitting. You know, I don't know how many guys can really fix an arm bar per se. And I don't know how many guys can really fix a stiff wrist if you've been doing it over this course of time. So catching the ball is number one. And I think the number two thing is their footwork. You know, now you can help some things. You can do the footwork part in a lot of areas. But to be able to understand angles, are they on their heels? Are their knees inside their feet? There's all these different things that we go into about their footwork. And that's even before we talk about ground balls and all the above.
You do a drill that I love watching with your infielders that involves footwork. And when you think about, you know, ground ball to the shortstop, you field, you know, you gather, you shuffle the feet, you throw to first base, and you'll do something where guys field and then you shuffle, 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 shuffle. And then you tell them when they can throw. Explain what that drill does and how that helps footwork and helps stay on balance.
Well, I think, you know, it's really, it's about, so we always talk about like, we always talk about your footwork. And so I feel like people talk about it all the time, but they don't work on it. And there's a lot of days that we'll just come out and we'll just work on footwork. But I think that particular drill is a lot like the quarterback drill. That's really where it comes from. And so I want guys to be comfortable with the ball in their hand. You know, as a shortstop, if you're not comfortable with the ball in their hand, you have some major, major problems. You know, but B, the other part is understanding how to get your feet in a position to go towards first base. I always like to use the term walk through your throws. So how, you know, a lot of guys catch and stand straight up, right? So this is really about our guys catching. And, you know, I always use the evolution of man. We've all seen that poster where they start small and they gradually get up. And it's a lot like an airplane ascending, right? Taking off. They don't all of a sudden go up in the sky. It's a gradual. And that's really what we're trying to do. We're trying to gradually get our guys in a position, in a power position to A, make the play, B, stay athletic. And that's really what it's about. It's for, and then why I tell them when to throw it is I just try to catch it. I try to see how they can react, you know, cause you'll see the first time everyone's going to try to catch and throw and you're like, hey, I didn't say anything yet, you know, or you'll see the guy that's going to hold onto the ball right away and you go, okay, now, and then he can't get the ball out of his glove. You know, so there's a little few different variations. Sometimes it's I want the ball in the glove. Sometimes I want the ball out of the glove, because I think when the ball's out of the glove, I think it speeds up your footwork, right? So it just depending on the guy is how we'll do it.
I feel like most of the time when throwing errors get made by an infielder, it's one of two reasons. Either number one, they had no chance and they probably shouldn't have thrown it because of just where the ball was hit. And then number two, it's because they lob it because they have so much time to think about it, and it throws off their mechanics because they're thinking about a nice, easy throw as opposed to just their normal throw that you have to do when you don't have as much time. What do you teach? What's your philosophy about the type of throw you want to make, whether that's third, short, second?
So I'm going to go on record here. I think second base is the toughest position to play.
Why is that?
I don't know how many times you've ever heard that. I don't know how many times anybody's ever said it, because I think most of the time every throw is going away from the play. So if you got nobody on, 99% of your plays, not 99, but a lot of your plays, let's say a little over half, are going away from the bag, right? Mm-hmm. So that's difficult. You know, I think Tula would argue with me on this, probably, but, you know, and I know how demanding shortstop is, but I think – there's a part of playing shortstop that you can, you know, you can get yourself in a pretty good position for the most part and try to get your momentum to first base. So that's partially why. So part of the arm strength thing is knowing when to use your arm. So if you take a guy, and you know, in professional baseball, if you take a guy that's played 162 games, you can't throw the ball 97 across the diamond for 162 games. It's just not even possible, right? You're going to end up – so that's where I think your footwork come. I think if you can – like yesterday, we tried to work on our guys. We were 50% arm, 100% footwork, right? So it was more about the feet. And then we play this game. You got to do that within 4.1 seconds. So we call it a blue runner in college. You'll get just about every blue runner in college at the college level. If you can do that, I think feel for the ball is something else. I think, you know, the farther you go away from the play. So I'm just talking about first base here. Farther you go to your right, the higher the arm slot has to be. If you're going to rock and throw on a backhand right now, if you're going to run through the ball, of course, the ball, you're going to lower the arm slot a little bit or a lot. So I think it's just knowing when to use your arm and when not to. And that's partially that's based on your footwork too, I believe. You know, is how's your angles to the ball? How's your first step to the ball? What's the runner doing? And then what's the speed of the ball? And there's so many factors that people don't even think about. They just see a guy and they're like, oh, he didn't catch the ball. Yeah, but there's a reason why, you know, he came and then stopped, or stopped and then came, or then just lobbed the ball over. It's like throwing on the run. You know, I'm a big believer in throwing on the run. I think you have to be athletic and to be able to do that. But you see a lot of uncoached infielders, specifically at the shortstop position. A ball's bouncing over the mound. They run. They do all the work to get to the ball, and then they shuffle their feet to stop. They stop their momentum. So it screws up everything. Instead of just, you know, Tulo told me this a long time ago, sometimes you just palm the ball over to first base because you've done all the work. You know, and that's part of it. And that's the little bit that goes into arm strength and knowing when to use your arm, when not to use your arm.
Let me ask you another question about arm strength and shortstops. I think the flashiest play for the shortstop, at least for me, is the ball that's in the hole. So Derek Jeter made the play famous, you know, where he fields, he jumps in the air, he throws to first. Trevor Story can do that. From my memory, Tulo's a guy who could run around it and be able to throw off balance from a lower arm slot. I thought last weekend in New Mexico, Peter Mendizona got caught in between whether he was going to backhand it or whether he was going to run around. He kind of got caught in between, wasn't able to make that play. I know being around Ron Washington, great infielder's coach, he really taught the backhand on certain plays because he felt like you could plant with the back foot all in one motion. What are some of your philosophies based on who the player is and what his arm strength is about how to make that play in the hole?
Yeah, I think you're dead on with all those guys. You know, Derek had the chance to, he had the arm strength to do that. Tulo loved running through the balls. I think that goes back, you know, now Tulo can jump and throw too with the best of them. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know Trevor Story very well, but I know obviously from watching him a little bit, how good he is defensively. But Tulo's always been one that can run through the ball. And that goes back to our days at Long Beach State. You know, we, back to our days with Coach Dwellers, Coach never taught the backhand. It was, I mean, we didn't backhand for 3 years. You know, for me, it was 4 years. I was a college guy, but for these other guys, it was 3 years. And those guys weren't allowed to backhand the ball, not in practice. Now, of course, right, if it's the athletic play and you had to dive and backhand, that's one thing, but we weren't allowed to set up and go. I think as I've grown in the infield, I've taken those fundamentals and I've grown into it to a degree that I think I use a guy like Pat Valaika, who I know you're really familiar with. And so my first year at UCLA, Pat, I didn't allow Pat to backhand the ball, right? Cause I needed him to have a foundation of certain plays. I need to have this found. I wanted to pour the foundation. So when it struggled, didn't go all the way down. He went down to a certain level. And then as we kept going and he showed he can do certain things fundamentally, he started by his junior year, all she did was backhand the ball. But there was two types of backhands, right? It was back. I think there's two of them. There's a backhand off the front foot. There's a backhand off the back foot. The backhand mm-hmm. off the back foot is the rock and throw, mm-hmm. right? So you're going, balls hit sharply. You're going a step and a half, and you backhand, you rock and throw because you got Lindor running down the line. There's the backhand off the front foot where it's more of a rake through the ball. So we tried to create, I think there's a lot of arguments on it, but I think it creates more range for your non-runner running shortstops, if that makes sense. So the guys that don't have a lot of foot speed, I think it creates more range with those guys if, in fact, they can do the backhand quite a bit. And that's part of, you know, Mendizona this weekend. He got – caught in between. And so I think that's faulty on my part for not making sure he understood certain plays. But I also told Peter that you got to go with your instincts. So whatever your instincts told you to do, that all ultimately always overweighs everything else. Because if your instincts, if that's your first instinct, normally it's right. And so whatever that was, you know, if you look at Tilly can really backhand and run through the ball. You know, that was something that helps him. You know, there's some hip he's really stiff hipped. So the backhand helps him create a little bit more range and puts him in a lot better position to be able to throw the ball and get the guy out. I've grown in that sense. I don't know if my mentor, Coach Weathers, likes it a whole lot. We talk about it all the time, and he's been up to Reno quite a bit to watch, and he just closes his eyes sometimes, and he's like, I can't watch that. But I do. I think it creates – it's a canvas, right? You're allowing these guys to – you're not pigeonholing them to a degree and putting them in this box. You're allowing them to grow if, in fact, they're ready to grow. And I use it as babies. When babies are ready to walk, then, you know, they got to crawl before they walk. And when they're ready to walk, there's no stopping them. And that's how I treat the back end.
When it comes to the double play pivot, I'm going to use a guy's name that most people probably have never heard of. His name is Elliot Soto. He was with the Albuquerque Isotopes the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. He played ball at Creighton. He's just really, really good defensively. And I remember asking him, how is it that you're so good with the pivot, with the transfer from the glove to the bare hand? And he told me that every time he plays catch, whether it's his first throw of the day, whether it's his last throw of the day, whenever he plays catch, he immediately does the transfer. Even if it's just very basic lob, just getting the arm, every time he immediately does that. What are some of the things that you do, that you teach about how to be as quick as possible on that transfer for that double play?
Well, yeah, he's on it. He nailed it, right? It's you know, and here's the other part of teaching is having these guys get the ball out of their glove. You know, they got to be comfortable, and that's the first thing we do. So no matter what happens it doesn't contradict the quarterback drill, but there's a reason why that happens. But there's also every time we play catch, the first thing we do is you got to get the ball out of your glove. That's all a part of our catch play routine. So we'll play catch at a certain distance for a few minutes, and it's just all about getting the ball. It's all about the transfer. It's not really about your footwork, right? It's all about the transfer, and it goes back into what I said. If the ball's out of your glove, your feet have to catch up, you know, and that's the one thing when the ball – and some for everybody to pay attention to. When the ball's in your glove, pay attention to how slower the feet work at times, you know, so – even if they're lobbing it or words, I lob a ball to somebody on the field, get the ball out of your gloves, right? Learn how to do that. Learn when to catch it. Learn that it's a redirect and not a catch. So we do that for a few minutes, and then we get back. We get actually into a ground ball routine throwing position. You know, so my point to that is, why would we go into a boxing match and not air box a little bit? You know, so we actually get into a ground ball throwing position where we're down, we're parallel to the ground, our hands are out in front, ball's in the glove, and they gotta go game-like for about 2 minutes on each end of the And the guy receiving the ball is working on a tag play at second base, third base, first base, wherever he plays, or he's working on a relay throw, which he can work on a relay throw to the base ahead, or he can work on the relay throw inside the diamond. So for instance, it'd be Josh Zamora, who's played third base for us for a few years. He can work on the redirection throw from left field to second base. You know, so that's something that we work on. So everybody's really working on something. You know, then obviously we extend it, and then we get back into beyond the 120 feet. Then you to a degree, turn into a pitcher, right, because you're trying to create these muscles in the back of your shoulder to work for arm strength down the road and build those muscles around your shoulder, and then you turn into a shuffle throw. Then it's a shuffle throw, and then we bring it back in into quick catch for 1 minute, and then we get into our cones and ladders, which is an everyday thing that we do. So you got to imagine if you're doing, our throwing program's 10 to 12 minutes. If you're doing that at game speed, I mean, you fielded potentially 25 to 30 ground balls visually before you even got into the boxing ring. So before we even took our ground balls. So that's something that we do. And I feel like it's paid off for us there. Again, I think it's the fact that you're always working on something. What's your intent in catch play? You know, I'm not a huge fan of position play or catch play. I think it's never very good. The intent sometimes I question in general, it's all wherever I've been. So that was just one way to make it a little bit more controlled environment. And then what are they working on? What's your intent?
what's your philosophy? This is another one of these plays that looks great on the plays of the week. And that is when you field it with the glove and then you flip it with the glove to whatever base, you don't even use a bare hand. It's also one of those where you better do it right. Right? Like if you flip it out of your glove and you can't get it out, or you flip it over the guy's head, then you look really bad. Do you teach it? Is it just instinct? Is there certain times when it's good? Obviously the only time that you're doing it is when you know it's going to be close, but what's your just thought overall about the flip with the glove where you don't even use the bare hand?
Yeah, I think it's instinct. I think it's, you know, we do have a point in our day or week, not, I wouldn't say day, it's more of a week where they're allowed to just do anything they want to do. You know, they can jump and throw, they can throw that ball from below their hip, Adrian Beltre. But you got to create this vision for them to do that. And so we do work on it. We've worked on the bare hand throw. I'll remember in Omaha in 2013, Valleca was our shortstop, and we was first and second versus Mississippi State in game one of the finals. And the ball was hit up the middle, and it was off of, you know, it's funny. You got all these big leaguers all over the field, Kramer, Valleca, and James Kaprielian was the pitcher. And ball was hit up the middle, and Cody Regis backhanded it and glove flipped it for an inning-ending double play in the eighth inning. And it was just so cool to finally see the fundamentals pay off, because the only way I think you're allowed to do that stuff is if your fundamentals are down pat. And I really believe that. I don't believe in, you know, it's like you can't run before you walk. Right. So I firmly believe in the fundamentals. So I'm good with whatever. Well, I'm good with it. I think if you're going to do it, you got to have a reason why. Hey, this guy, I couldn't get the ball in my glove, or my momentum was going that way. Because what other people don't understand is they don't understand what momentum does in terms of where your body's going. Sometimes it slows your momentum down. It slows the play down to actually reach in and get the ball out of your glove.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people don't understand that. So I'm good with it. I want to make sure when they do it, that they're convicted in it. And if they're convicted in it as a coach, what are you going to tell them? And that's the big teaching point.
Going back to your days as a shortstop, what was your favorite play to make? What's the play that you made, especially when the guy looks over his shoulder at you afterwards, like, really? You just got me on that play? Like, what was it in the hole? Was it up the middle? Was it the bare hand? Was it a catch down the line? Like, what was your favorite play to make as a shortstop?
Probably the one up the middle, because I was a little backwards. Normally people are better glove side. I was not better glove side. It took me more work to work to my glove side. So when I switched my senior year to second base, it was tougher because I wasn't very good to my glove side. When I switched to second, so when I went to my glove side in the four hole, it was a little difficult because, you know, you're really going away from the play. Mm-hmm. You're trying to get some depth and you're trying to do different things. So probably the play up the middle, because I think you got some options. I think depending on your angle, depending on how hard the ball's hit, are you coming through the ball? Are you going into right center field as a shortstop? Are you spinning? You know, I think the spin's an interesting one because your eyes never catch up with your head, something that guys don't ever think about. You know, you got to really get your head turned around. And normally your eyes are just a little behind your head if you've ever tried to do that. So that was probably my favorite one. I like it to this day. Even I took ground balls yesterday, and I like it to this day doing it that way.
How often do you take ground balls?
When I was younger, I mean, I'm only 39, but when I was younger, it was just about every day.
Okay.
With them, as I get older, it just depends. I was out yesterday with those guys. I felt like it was the right time for us to do it. And, we were doing an accuracy deal at first base, and that was partly why I did it. So I'll try to once a week at least.
Yeah, talking to Miles, he admitted that, first of all, he said that he had a bad fall, but then like things came around in the spring for him. But he also said that he's a big visual learner and he just wasn't picking things up. But then once he saw, and it must have been you, once he saw you do it, then he was able to learn, because everybody learns a little bit different. And so sometimes that's the most important thing, is just be able to show them yourself. This is exactly what I mean, footwork, arm work, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think probably people are more visual learners nowadays. You know, it's definitely, we're definitely out of the times of do what I say just because I told you so. You have to see it. And so I think it helped, you know, with those guys. I was taking ground balls all the time. I mean, it was just about every day, early work, some late work there in practice. And it was just double play turns. You know, that's a big one. I love doing a drill at second base where you close your eyes and you're just staying on the bag and you're working really just being with your feet and your arm path and to be able to throw the ball to second or first base, you know, and you'll see the first time it's sprayed all over the place. Right. The second time it's a little closer. By the end of the day or the end of the week, they're pretty good at it.
That sounds like a really good one. I like that. Let's go into a little bit more detail. So you're second base or shortstop or both?
Yeah. So really so the shortstop one's a little easier, but there again, it's all about your body placement, right? So if I was doing it from short, I'd have to put them at the bag, mm-hmm. right? So if I'm doing it from short, normally we touch the bag with our right foot, right? Because mm-hmm. you're kind of hauling across the bag, catching it and going. But the problem is that a lot of shortstops keep going into the four hole and the right field foul hole. Well, we all know that unless you have incredible feel for the ball, you know, you're going to have to be somewhat aligned with your lower half somewhere. So I'll put them right at the bag and I have the ball in their hand or in their glove. It just kind of depends what I'm working on. And they have to actually move their feet towards first base and throw the ball so they can feel their feet, but they also can feel their arm path. That's the whole other thing about feel is at 39, I know my arm path to the detailed minuscule, where it's going to go, what it's going to do. These guys don't know. They just get up and go and think, you know, I've been throwing my whole life, but you don't really ever pay attention, stop to pay attention. What are you feeling on your arm path? And then it was second base. I do it where the left foot's in the back. So we would set them up. We'd split the back part of the base. So the center field side of the base between their legs, left foot's on the bag. And I put the ball in their glove now, right? Cause that's the hardest thing on the pivot, that and your footwork. So you put them there and you close your eyes and you tell them to go. And they have to transfer, get the ball out and throw and finish the play. So it's something that we've done. I mean, I learned it from Coach Weathers, and that was something we did. That was a mainstay for us at Long Beach. And that's what really helped me learn how to turn a double play. I never played second base until I was 22 years old, you know, so to be honest with you, it was foreign to me. I had no idea.
Yeah.
And then you got a big league shortstop who was really demanding, you know, in a good way about, you know, this and that. And well, you better step up your game. I mean, you better, you know, because at some point, you know, I'll never forget at one time he didn't feed me the ball. We're playing at Fullerton. And he's
talking about Tulo right now.
Yeah, Tulo. He ran literally 7 feet to touch the bag and he didn't feed me the ball. And so we had a meeting in the dugout and I was like, man, what, you know, and so but it's good. It's good. Those are why you do those drills, so everybody can build trust and all that stuff.
So how long did it take for Tulo to trust you that he didn't have to run 7 feet to step on the base and do the double play himself?
You know, we were pretty good. We have a great relationship. I mean, he's one of my best friends. You know, we've been in each other's wedding. I think what helped us actually, we must have been, I remember the play, but we must have been at a little bit of a differences, but we worked out prior to that summer. You know, so he stayed back. He went to Team USA the year before, or maybe he was leaving for Team USA later. But when I was transferring, I committed to Long Beach State as a senior. We worked out all summer together or until he left. Mm-hmm. So we did have a familiarity with him, and I was trying to come in and take his job. You know, so unfortunately that didn't work out, and it was probably the right decision. by our coach. So I ended up playing second base, played a little third base, and I feel like it just helped me grow as an infield coach now going, you know, now looking forward.
All right, let's wrap things up by talking a little bit more about Miles Mastroboni. Yeah. He just told us about how he committed to the previous coach and he wasn't quite sure, but then he heard good things about you and he was very very grateful for everything that he learned from you. What made him a good shortstop? Kind of a two-part question. What made him a good shortstop? And then what are those skills that have allowed him to become a really good utility guy now in the Rays organization?
Well, number one, you know, going back to, he almost didn't come to Nevada. And I'll never forget the first phone call I made. I don't know where I was at. And he's like, I don't know, you know, I committed to Coach Johnson and, you know, this and that. And I'm like, you know, the only thing I told him was, you have to trust me. Like, just please trust me. Here's my track record. I'll get you better. You'll get yourself better. This is a great spot for you. And to his credit, he did. He believed in it. And most importantly, he believed in himself, right? He believed in himself that no matter where he was going to go, he was going to be on the right path. And so that was number one. But number two, he did not have a good fall here. We tried to play him at short because he can really run and he can really throw. I mean, he has a bazooka for an arm. And you love that because it allows you to not be so fine in some other areas. And he had a tough fall. He had a tough fall running the system here. I feel, you know, not that I'm a quarterback, offensive coordinator or defensive coordinator, but we have a unique system. And if you can't run it right, then it takes a toll on you, you know? And so he had a hard time with that at first. And so I made the switch and moved him to second base. And I'm telling you, he came back in January, just took off. He took off, he caught the ball. He made some plays that were incredible, up the middle, you know, in the four hole, pop-ups in the shallow center. I mean, he's just a supreme athlete. And I think that's why he's succeeding in professional baseball. I think, you know, the fact now that you have a guy, and I got to believe it's easy for a manager, when you have a guy that can play, you know, seven spots, I mean, who doesn't want that guy? You know, and I think that's one thing that we always try to do here. We just try to create positionless position players. And, you know, you want to be able to have plug and play guys to where, hey, this guy needs a day off. And Miles is going to find himself in the big leagues for that reason, amongst everything else that I've already said. But he's going to find himself in the big leagues. And we all know Ben Zobrist made a living doing that.
Yeah.
And there's no reason why Miles can't make a living playing all over the field, spelling the shortstop, spelling the second baseman, spelling the left fielder, coming to play first on a defensive replacement when, you know, the guy that has 40 home runs needs to come out of the game. I mean, there's a lot. And I think he's with the perfect organization to do that. They value that stuff. I just know from Evan being in Tampa for all those years, you know, what those guys value, and they value what Miles brings to the table. So I'm looking forward to watching. It's been great to watch him develop.
Yeah, he had some kind of spring. Looking forward to adding his banner to the Wolfpack in the major leagues that are outside of Pacoli Park.
Yeah, man, it's I'm excited, and I'll definitely be on the first flight. I've always tried to, you know, some guys that I've coached have always tried to get on the first flight out, no matter when and where it is. I remember when Valleca did it. I, for whatever reason, I couldn't make Plutko's, even though he was a pitcher, but I couldn't make Adams. But I remember jumping on the first flight. I was in Lake Tahoe and I with my family, and I left and drove back to Reno. And then I jumped on a plane that night and flew to Denver. And but I'll be on the first flight, man, when Miles gets the call. That's for sure.
Looking forward to that one. All right, TJ, thanks so much for your time. This was a good episode. I love talking infield defense with you. Can do it for a long time. And once again, thanks.
Awesome. Thanks, Josh. Appreciate it.
All right. This was episode 3 of Howling with the Pack. I'm your host, Josh Sushan. We'll talk to you again next week. This is Howling with the Pack.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.